Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Monday, September 20th, Joe Donahue and Alan Shartok were joined by immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
This from the New York Times from Port-au-Prince. The first Haitians deported from a makeshift camp in Texas landed in their home country Sunday. Amid sweltering heat, anger, and confusion as Haitian officials beseech the United States to stop the flights because the country is in crisis and cannot handle thousands of homeless deportees. We are here to say welcome. They can come back and stay in Haiti, but they are very agitated, said the head of Haiti's National Migration Office. They don't accept the forced return. They said the authorities expected about 14,000 Haitians will be expelled from the United States over the coming 3 weeks. An encampment of about that size has formed in the Texas border town of Del Rio in recent days as Haitian and other migrants crossed over the Rio Grande from Mexico. The Biden administration has said it is moving swiftly to deport them under a Trump-era pandemic order. On Sunday alone, officials in Haiti were preparing for 3 flights of migrants to arrive in Port-au-Prince, the capital. After that, they expect 6 flights a day for 3 weeks, split between Port-au-Prince and another coastal city. Beyond that, little was certain. Sienna, let me begin with you. I mean, given what we know about Haiti and the great political and social tumult in Haiti, as well as the devastation of an earthquake, it just seems counterintuitive to then send people to a place that is having a hard enough time as it is.
Exactly. So I consider myself very patient when it comes to the Biden administration and the immigration rollout and what they're doing there. But this situation with Haiti has been bad since May, in my opinion. In May, the Biden administration announced temporary protected status for Haitians, that they were going to allow them to remain in the U.S. if they were already here. And then they did not even roll out the regulations or issue the register for the temporary protective status until August. So you had all these months between May and August where the Haitians were already in the U.S., were waiting, you know, to apply and register for this temporary protective status. And I think it was during this time frame where you had that you gave also additional time for the coyotes and individuals to go and say, come to the U.S. This is a safe time to come to the U.S. Because from May to August, there were no announcements about how they were going to roll out the temporary protective status process for Haitians. So I think there's been a miscommunication, and it's disappointing to see how they're reacting and sending them back to Haiti when just early August, a few weeks ago, they finally released the register where they go into detail about why individuals from Haiti in the U.S. need to be protected and they need to stay and remain in the U.S., about the current economic national hope of Haiti, and they had to give these detailed reasons why these individuals need temporary protective status. And then a few weeks later, we see the individuals coming from Central America to the border, and they're sending them out back, deporting them back to Haiti. It's just terrible to see what's going on there, I must say. Usually I try to stay neutral and give the Biden administration, you know, the benefit of the doubt. But in this, I'm very disappointed that they're using Title 42 to deport them back to Haiti when just a few weeks ago they said that basically they're going to protect them. It's very unfortunate. And they can remedy this. And I hope they do in the upcoming weeks.
Sarah Rogerson.
There is absolutely no reason for this. I don't even know. I do know where to start. I've been thinking about it all weekend. DHS issued over the weekend a memo that basically is an about face from where we were 3 weeks ago in terms of enforcement, the Del Rio crossing. So other reports, in addition to what the New York Times is reporting, are also saying that Customs and Border Patrol agents are whipping individuals who are attempting to cross, including individuals from Haiti. if the Biden administration thinks they can hide behind Title 42 and say, oh, this is a Trump policy, I mean, that's just completely disingenuous, because that was one of the things that advocates urged this administration to overturn on day one. You know, Title 42 is a federal law that allows for the immediate expulsion of individuals who have come from a country that has had an outbreak of a communicable disease. So when we're talking about COVID, that means like the globe, basically. So it's just a blanket self-permission to deport anyone who's recently arrived. Last in, first out policy. There's also still expedited consideration of recent arrivals under our asylum system. So meaning people whose cases have been waiting around for 12 years waiting to be adjudicated will sit there, where someone who may have a stronger case but arrived yesterday might be removed from the country more quickly in an expedited process. That's not under Title 42. That's a separate type of expedited. How about we not use legal terms? It's another legal way to kick people out of the country, right? We use all these nice terms when we're talking about immigration that makes it feel a little bit more legitimate. It's not. We are committing human rights violations. We are neglecting our humanitarian obligations. And it's pretty clear how we feel about people that don't represent the traditional model of what a successful immigrant might look like in the United States. And it's a moral failing by this administration, just full stop.
You mentioned, Sienna, that, you know, we can do something about this. So what's step one and how fast can it happen?
Well, right now, the temporary protective status that they are allowing individuals in the U.S. to have, I mean, the start date, you had to be in the country on August 3rd. I believe it's August 3rd. And so I think what needs to happen is they need to expand that. They need to give temporary protective status to Haitians, and they need to allow them to enter. I think that's what needs to happen. The same way that we are dealing with Afghanistan individuals that are coming from the U.S., coming from Afghanistan, and they're allowed to apply for parole. They're making accommodations for them in other countries nearby to apply for parole and enter the country. That same step could be taken for the Haitians who are fleeing their country, who don't have a place to go back to that's stable. No one can argue that Haiti is an ideal place to return somebody to right now. I mean, that is, it's really bad. And I think there are steps that the Biden administration can take right away to help the Haitians, similar to what they're doing to help Afghanistan.
We have an obligation in this country, and we have the ability, and we have plenty of jobs available for everyone, including some of the jobs that these folks were doing in Brazil and other countries that they were in before they arrived in the United States. The types of people that we need here in our country, not to make it a financial issue, because it's not. It's a moral and humanitarian one. But I know that there are people that are saying, well, when does it end? And the answer is we have lots of infrastructure. Immigrants add so much to our country, and we've been deprived of them for years. To deprive ourselves further is just short-sighted.
All right, let's go to some letters here. Earl writes, the panel seems to assume all leftists agree with relaxed immigration, not so. Is what we are talking about, Sienna or Sarah, I'll let you battle this out between who wants to answer the question, is all...
No.
Okay.
Yeah, there is no such thing as relaxed immigration. There hasn't been since 9/11. It's getting worse and worse and tighter and tighter. There's no such thing. It's not relaxed. You know what? Until the 1920s, we didn't even have a border patrol. And, it's just remarkable how soon we forget. The last 20 years have been a rapid militarization and escalation and intensive restriction of migration policies beyond anything that historically we've ever seen before. So our status quo right now is the most restrictive environment that we have ever seen in this, well, except for under Trump's, you know, some of the policies that they came up with to actually ban entire groups from the country, right, which were ultimately found to be mostly illegal and mostly overturned. So, you know, there is no such thing as relaxed immigration, but there should be. There is such thing. as an international and moral obligation to provide humanitarian assistance to individuals who are fleeing a host of terrible things going on in their country, especially if our country recognizes what's happening in that country. We are literally sending people back to in some cases, their death, without exaggeration. That is not a sign of a liberal migration policy.
Sienna, anything you'd like to add?
I would just say that is the whole purpose of the temporary protective status, right, is to allow people to come during these times of need to the U.S. and have this protective status until they can return to their home country. So that's the whole function of this tool, and they're not even utilizing it. It's just very upsetting.
Alan.
Well, I have a feeling that Biden is very carefully judging what this country wants. I have listened carefully to what our experts have said, and I certainly agree with it. I mean, what has happened to Haiti is nothing short of hell. And I understand why good Americans want to allow those folks who are most affected, who are close to this country, relatively close, to come into the country. And especially good arguments on the availability of jobs becomes something that I really am impressed by. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, you can be sure that Joe Biden and his people are looking carefully at what most Americans think here. And I have a feeling this is part of their politics of the time.
Libby Post.
You know, we're trading one humanitarian crisis, the one at the border, for another in Haiti. And we're going to be paying the bill one way or the other. And I think Alan has a point about polling and where Americans are at and the calculus for the 2022 elections. But I also know that there are so many jobs here that are open and people aren't taking, that we could probably put a lot of these folks to work if we could get them resettled. I mean, in Albany, you know, we talked about the Afghans before. In Albany, we're going to be resettling 100 people just here alone from Afghanistan. And that's a humanitarian crisis that we created. And I have to say, Haiti might also be a humanitarian crisis that we created a very, very long time ago. But we're going to be paying the bill one way or the other.
When I heard the frustration in both from both Sarah and Sienna, and I'm interested, I guess, in where that goes. Is there an overall concern of, because of this Biden tactic, for want of a better term, that it could spell concern for other immigration issues?
Well, yeah, we've already seen this again, this political unease around immigration. And I do want to draw attention, I hate doing this, but the Cato Institute did a recent poll regarding American attitudes towards migration. Support for more immigration has increased over the past several decades by all Republicans, independents, Democrats over the last 20 years have all increased in terms of the percentage of people who support more migration, with, of course, Democrats leading the pack. Views about whether it should be increased, kept at its present level, or decreased is a different question. But support for more immigration generally has increased across all sectors, and Americans are pretty evenly divided about how much migration. I guess it's a super short version and summary. So, you know, over the weekend, the Senate parliamentarian issued a decision basically saying that the budget reconciliation bill and the immigration provisions, the legalization provisions that were proposed, again, to put people on a lawful path to citizenship, could not be accomplished through the budget reconciliation process. There's all sorts of like intellectually inconsistent reasoning around that decision. And of course, the fight's not over for a legalization provision, which would chip away at this problem. But we're already seeing a shift in the landscape. And I don't know if they're connected, but I guess sort of trying to read the zeitgeist of Americans on this immigration topic, it doesn't look good.
We got this.
I would just
go ahead, Santa. Yeah.
And I would just say very quickly, and that this translates to the USCIS, the asylum officers, and to the judges, right? So on the ground, when I'm going into court and I'm arguing for a client from Haiti about the danger of returning to Haiti, and you have deportations happening going back to Haiti from the U.S. government, it's counterintuitive, right? It's not helpful to our cases here that we're having in court today or in front of asylum officers today when we're trying to argue that it's not safe for our clients to go back for whatever reason. And so the tenor of the Biden administration towards Haiti does trickle down and affect these our individuals currently in the U.S. going through the immigration system. And so that's why it's so important that they set a certain tone. And we were so excited when they released the register about the temporary protective status, because they went through and they talked about what was going on in Haiti and why these individuals had to remain here. But in just a few weeks, by turning their back, so to speak, on the Haitians at the border, they've already, you know, turned over everything they just said in that register, the federal register about it.
Got this letter from Wynn, who says, when is it appropriate to return immigrants to their countries?
When they're not seeking asylum under international immigration, under international law and domestic immigration law, and or, you know, we need to rewrite the whole thing. And I'd be interested in what people's thoughts are. This is a fascinating conversation. This is part of the reason why I love teaching these classes at Albany Law School, because it really depends on your value system, where you came from, what informed your upbringing, your proximity to a migration story generationally, and a lot of other factors. And people come out on all different ends of this. But at some point, and I would say soon, it's going to be a conversation that we need to have nationally, not just every once in a while, but something is going to force a conversation that creates comprehensive reform. I don't know what it is, and I don't know if it will be in my lifetime. It hasn't happened yet. But in the meantime, people are getting hurt. So I don't know. Listeners, you tell us, who do you think, you know, we should accept? Because I'm exhausted from a career of trying to convince this government to accept children and vulnerable people in a host of terrible circumstances. I'm exhausted of writing 20-page affidavits and having people deported anyway. It's just, you know, I'm obviously frustrated. But I think we should.
I completely agree with Sarah, but I actually do have an example of when immigrants can return to their home country. What happened is my family is from Liberia. In the 1980s, there was a civil war. A lot of my family came to the U.S. They had temporary protective status under from the government to stay and remain in the U.S. to work. And so we had a lot of Liberians here in the U.S. while the civil war was going on. During the recovery, they continued to have temporary protective status. After the Ebola scare, now that Liberia is more well-established, we have family members going back to Liberia. Because I think what a lot of people in the U.S. fail to realize is that a lot of people want to return to their home country, where they're comfortable, where they're comfortable with the culture, where they know the languages. And so there is a way, there is time when people go back to their home countries. It's not always come back to the U.S., come to the U.S. and stay forever. That's a choice. But some people do return when their country is stable again. And so I think that it's not a fair assumption that just because people enter this country and make a better life for themselves during a time when times are hard in their home country, that they won't eventually return to their home country.
Sienna Freeman-Tolbert on the Roundtable panel on Monday, September 20th. Please note, as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, September 23rd, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue spoke with Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Acarius-Kelly, Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman Ira Fussfeld, and Chairman of Capital District Latinos Dan Irizarry.
Why don't we talk about the fact that the former president will talk about Donald Trump suing the New York Times and his niece. The Washington Post says in their headline, if history is a guide, he probably won't win. Donald Trump has once again sued a news organization, alleging that its reporting was unfair to him. If history is any guide, this is only also likely to generate a flurry of attention before quietly stalling out. Trump's latest lawsuit filed Tuesday is aimed at the New York Times and his niece, Mary Trump. It centers on the Trump's publication of a 2018 of a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation of Trump's alleged tax avoidance tactics in the history of his family inheritance. The suit claims that Mary Trump and three Times reporters engaged in an insidious plot culminating in a breach of contract when the paper published records about the former president's finances that were subject to a 2001 family confidentiality agreement. Mary Trump has publicly acknowledged that she was a primary source for the Times' story. Trump has threatened to sue news organizations, including the Times, for decades, but has followed through on only a handful of occasions. It's not clear whether he has ever prevailed in any action that he or his political operation has brought over reporting or published commentary, either in court or through a settlement trial. He has repeatedly run up against laws and judicial rulings that make it difficult for public figures to win judgments against news organizations. As a result, courts have dismissed almost all of those claims, including one last year in which his brother Robert sought to prevent Mary Trump from publishing a memoir about the family that became a bestseller. That is the first book. Mary Trump now has a second book out, and they were unable to stop that as well. Alan.
Well, you know, part of his penchant for suing is to get other people to spend the money that they may or may not have. I don't know that Mary Trump has that much money, certainly not compared to Donald Trump. And it's a well-known thing. I mean, you got to go find a lawyer. You got to, yep. If you can find one, you got to pay them, and you got to pay them a lot of money. You know, there certainly are people who will do it for nothing, but in the end, it's a technique that a bully would use, and this bully has used it all along.
And also, I mean, just when you were talking about the overall cost, I just completely lost track of the thought I had in my head. I'll come back to it. Vera, go ahead.
For me, I just look at the situation and I think, wow, you know, Trump is up to his standard process of trying to just bully, silence, intimidate, and somehow stir up the base to donate to his cause.
Exactly.
So
and that was
this is the, yeah, this
you,
is a
you
public,
just reminded me
effort.
Of oh, what good. I was going to say, which is that when Alan was talking about money, I was also thinking that the money that he'll make on the back of this, of they're out to get me, the bad New York Times, my bad family members, and you can make money on top of it. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Vera, go ahead. But thank you for
Well, I mean, that was my main point. It's about publicity. If he's not succeeding any other way, that's the one way through which he generally reaches his base and gets them re-energized. So that's what this is. It's an effort to get his base reconnected. Since the last, protest event in Washington, D.C. in front of the Capitol didn't work out that well for him in terms of numbers, he's thinking, oh, gosh, I got to do something to get the base excited again.
All right. Let's go to Ira.
Well, you both have described it well. The Washington Post story that you cited describes it well. We know that Trump has spent a considerable amount of time over his entire history in public life taking people to court. We know that often he doesn't pay the lawyers that he hires, so he finds it more difficult to find a lawyer from each suit. We know that this, to my knowledge, this suit does not contain the word libel, so he's not suggesting that what was written about him was untrue, only that it was unfair. And he will lose this suit if he pursues it any further. It may be dismissed at a summary judgment, which will lessen the financial burden that Mary Trump may face. And in fact, she may face no financial burden if she seeks court costs from Trump after it is dismissed. And as Vera said, he is doing this because he's going after the quote-unquote fake news, so his supporters will see that he's not afraid to go after the fake news, and this specific case is going to go away very quickly. It's laughable. The New York Times is entirely in the clear. You don't have to be a lawyer or a journalist to know that, and it's just more smoke and mirrors by this guy.
Dan.
Yes, Joe. I'd like to take narcissism for $200, please.
Go ahead. You have command of the board.
This is a narcissistic personality, right? Everything has to be about him. He must wake up every day, as he did when he was in the White House, and consider what he could do to remain relevant. And this is just another, this is the 6 foot whatever, 350-pound toddler jumping up and down and saying, look at me, look at me.
So far, not since the election, which obviously he lost, and so it didn't work in helping him get reelected, but it seems to be working in continuing to make him the central figure of the Republican Party, and that somebody who is not going away, and this kind of lawsuit helps him do that.
Let's try to remember, everybody, that this is the Trump Supreme Court. That while, Ira's injunction, his warning that, in the past, the First Amendment has really stood the test of time, and we have seen New York Times versus Sullivan and all of those cases in which, the right of the press to even be wrong is quite strong. Nevertheless, we've got those characters sitting up there on the Supreme Court, many of whom have been called out by the press. I would just like to remind everybody that there is the possibility that this kind of a case goes up the line and gets to that court.
I don't think that's going to happen with this case. This is a loser from the starting gate, and that's going to be determined very quickly by lower court judges.
Well, Ira, my dear friend.
Yeah, I understand the Supreme Court is out there, but he's going to have to find a lawyer willing to work for free to get it all the way up to the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, say that again.
He's going to have to find lawyers willing to work for free because the longer it takes, it costs him money too, and money that he typically doesn't pay. And if he wants to find some pro bono lawyers who want to affiliate themselves with him, then he'll find those lawyers. But I don't know anything about the lawyer who he has hired for this course, for this case, other than he is described in the story in the Washington Post as a Bedminster, New Jersey-based attorney. And I don't want to leap to too many conclusions, but it is unfair to conclude that this is somebody he met at the golf course that he owns.
Or he's the golf course's attorney. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. He could be a member. Who knows? And I'm not disparaging this lawyer, but he is a Bedminster lawyer. He's not a Washington lawyer. He's not a New York City lawyer. And,
I smell free membership at Bedminster.
Yeah, well, that's true. That that could be, what's the phrase? I can't remember. He'll get that instead of a
quid pro quo.
Quid pro quo. But yeah, I don't even think it would probably be a membership.
In kind.
Maybe just get like a continental breakfast for two nights or so, or two mornings, something like that.
Maybe you'll give him an extra two strokes on the course.
Not where I thought you were going, but thank you. Heather writes, quite frankly, after seeing how the government has handled the pandemic, I'm more than happy for the drug companies to control the process, unfortunately. Also, if other countries are allowed to produce the vaccine, don't you have the risk that the governments will sell those vaccines for profit rather than distributing them to their own people? Wasn't that issue discussed when India was being ravaged by the Delta variant? I'm sure the panelists are much more knowledgeable than I am on these matters, but it seems that these are valid questions. What do you think?
Sure, they're valid questions, and as long as corruption exists, and it does in many of these countries, we have seen it time and again, people will take advantage of that, and it's a very good question.
Vera?
Well, dissemination of the vaccine is a significant issue. I think Biden also announced, in addition to donating vaccines, that us all Americans, or taxpayers, are sending $320 million to a fund that will help to actually educate health professionals on how, in various countries, how to store and then disseminate the vaccine. So this is not a simple bring it to the country and then it's over, right? And corruption is everywhere at different levels, of course. But we also need to remember that not all the vaccines were developed in the United States either. You know, there's the assumption that the vaccines come from within the United States. That is not correct. Vaccines are often frequently developed by teams, global teams. And we have a number of Pfizer, for example, manufacturers here, but BioNTech is the company in Germany that actually developed this vaccine. And interestingly enough, the founders of that company are immigrants to Germany. So, this is a multi-layered, complex issue, and nobody should dominate access and control over vaccines.
Dan or Ira, anything to add to that?
No, I bow to Vera's expertise.
All right. Let's go.
Wondering, maybe Vera can shed some light on this. What was it like when the antivirals for AIDS were discovered? I mean, you know, we all know the Bush administration, or rather George Bush, after his post presidency, made it his mission to get people the drugs, the antivirals to treat AIDS. Was there a similar kind of dynamic playing where the developed countries were getting all that technology?
Mm-hmm. It's very similar, Dan. It's a very good question. Actually, Dr. Fauci was deeply involved in that particular process with the antiretroviral medications. And he was also, he now talks about how he should have been faster in terms of supporting the development of that particular medication. And then, of course, it was primarily available to people in the United States and Western Europe. And then only later was it disseminated in sub-Saharan African countries, which suffered greatly for a decade longer because the medication was not made accessible for people unless they were extremely wealthy. So very similar patterns existed then.
Joseph writes, great show today, panel. As always, it seems that too much attention is being paid to Mr. Trump. It's like fanning a dying flame. We should focus on the current administration and give them a chance for their efforts to shine. Biden is not perfect, but then again, who is? He has blundered with the Afghanistan withdrawal and now with the Haitian refugees. He also has done a lot of good, too. He ramped up the availability of vaccine. He has comforted so many who are grieving and fearful. There is much more access to him in the administration than before. I encourage your panel to please avoid discussion about Mr. Trump. That's hard to do.
I think it's a big mistake. You know, Hitler had his time. He was coming up. They put him in jail for a little while, and he was back with force. I think this guy, Trump, is the greatest threat to the American democracy we have ever seen, ever. So therefore, I think to put our heads in the sand is a big mistake.
And
yeah, I agree. You ignore Trump at your own risk. It's you got to talk about him. You got to keep your eye on him, because if we don't, I don't like the alternative.
And then we also have this letter real quick from Bill. I cannot understand how Trump can run again. So many lies, so much irresponsibility, so many felonies. Are you saying that he won't be indicted or tried before 2024? I am dumbfounded. So the other big story I wanted to get to is, of course, the Haitian border policy and what is going on. And we have been talking about the story all week. We'll continue to talk about it. Biden pushes deterrent border policy after promising, quote, a humane approach. The deportation of Haitian migrants is a stark example of how President Biden has deployed some of the most aggressive approaches to immigration put in place by former President Donald Trump. The images could have come straight from Trump's immigration playbook. Mounted Border Patrol agents rounding up desperate Haitian families at the southwestern border for rapid deportation from the United States. In fact, the aggressive effort to quickly clear a makeshift camp in Del Rio, Texas, of more than 15,000 Haitian migrants was part of a Biden administration response that included, quote-unquote, surging agents to the overrun area using a public health immigration rule invoked by Mr. Trump to send many people home. President Biden's spokeswoman said the scenes of agents on horseback were horrific and not acceptable or appropriate. Vice President Kamala Harris said human beings should never be treated that way. The Department of Homeland Security said it was investigating. Still, the deportations are a stark example of how Mr. Biden, who declared on February 2nd that his goal was to undo the moral and national shame of the previous administration, is deploying some of the most aggressive approaches to immigration put in place by Mr. Trump over the past 4 years. Dan, let's start with you.
Well, I think it's important to understand the reason why so many Haitians have migrated. I think some of the reading that I've done points to the fact that many were refugees after the hurricane, I think it was 10 years ago, and many fled to Chile and Brazil. And they found that their welcome was short-lived, and they heard about a change in policy here in the United States for 150,000 Haitian migrants already in country, I think. And according to the sources that I've read, a lot of misinformation spread that now it was the time for Haitians to come and get visas. So again, nuance is part of this discussion. And, you know, we have no tolerance for nuance anymore as a country.
No.
And so some of these elements are missed. So there is a reason why these things are happening that are outside of our control. Now, what is within our control is immigration policy, and we already know that the Republicans will never go for anything except for, you know, spikes on the border wall and a no immigration policy.
I mean, the optics are bad. I just don't know who in a room thought that those optics could ever be good.
There are decisions implemented along the border that are not controlled by decision makers in Washington, D.C., or even in the regional offices along the border. This is Border Patrol officers on horseback chasing and beating black Haitians. This is what people sometimes do when they're empowered along the border and they feel justified.
Why were they empowered? Why were they empowered, number one? And number two, yes, they were caught. But this would go, if that picture didn't exist, we wouldn't know, you know, we probably wouldn't be talking about this, but it's still the policy. The policy hasn't been changed.
He's the president of the United States, right. Biden. He's responsible for the people who are working for him and will be held that way. And
yes.
So you can't, right? I mean, you just can't say these are outliers who...
No, these are not outliers. Yeah. I'm saying that it's common practice along the border. If you go to the border and spend some quality time there, you see behavior like this it's been like this for 20 years.
Quality time at the border? Go ahead.
I get it, but it is the responsibility of the head person to lay down the law and to create the kinds of situation where people will, this will not happen.
Absolutely.
You have to hold somebody responsible.
All I want to say is that this is a particularly bad film that is now available generally, but things along those lines have existed for decades. What really bothers me about the Biden administration at the moment is that they're blocking access for Haitians and others along the border to actually use the legal asylum system to get their credible fear screenings. That is part of required U.S. law. If you arrive on the border, you have a right to be interviewed and heard and explain your situation. What the Biden administration so far has permitted was loading people onto planes and flying them back by, I think, 1,500 or 2,000 have been returned to Haiti. Irrespective of if they actually recently came from Haiti or, as Dan said, had lived for years in Brazil or Chile. So that is issue number one. And that has already been reversed. Now, all of a sudden, the last couple of days, because of all this critique of not following existing U.S. asylum law, You know, people are now let into the country. They apparently have cuffs around their ankles so they can be traced. But so what is the actual process? Some have been sent home. Tens of thousands are now allowed in the country. Others are in those dreadful border encampments. We definitely need a revision of immigration law, and we most certainly need to ensure that we follow existent asylum regulations so that everybody can get at least a basic screening.
Vera Icarius-Kelly on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 23rd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Friday's show, Joe Donahue and Alan Shartok were joined by investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, and lecturer and adjunct professor in communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, Terry Gibson.
Let's talk a little bit about John Kerry. He is a really interesting figure in the Biden administration, who is the first presidential envoy for the climate. And I can remember once on the show talking about him and his role, and since then, really nothing. There is a major piece in the New York Times about his sales pitch to save the planet, their headline, and that he wants to persuade world leaders to, quote, do what the science tells us. And as the article points out, with global climate talks less than 2 months away, he faces a tough path. So I wanted to just take a few moments to talk about his role, because even though the subject of climate change has certainly been something that the administration has dealt with in many ways, we do not hear a lot of the words of John Kerry.
Yeah, I mean, I love this article by Lisa Friedman, an excellent New York Times reporter who, if you're interested in climate change, you should be following Lisa Friedman's writing. She gets to the facts. She also has such a beautiful way of phrasing things. She describes Kerry as a pedigreed traveling salesman for the environment, shuffling from country to country with an urgent plea to save the planet. And that we haven't heard from him because he's been in 14 countries in the last 9 months, and he understands the importance of this upcoming United Nations conference in Glasgow, Scotland, which starts November 1st. This is an international issue, and we need to get international diplomacy into high gear. And I didn't know until I read this article that President Biden coaxed him out of retirement and asked him to do this role. And apparently Kerry's friends say he wasn't very good at retirement anyway. But Kerry has 35 policy experts working with him. He's working nonstop. You know, the tone of the article is, yikes, you know, this is kind of discouraging. And most notably, on climate change, we're still feeling the effects of Trump's 4 years in office, because heads of state are saying to Kerry, what happens, you know, if Trump comes back in? You know, the United States really has lost credibility on the international stage. And so there's been some hesitancy for large industrial countries that are emitting a lot of greenhouse gases, most notably India, Brazil, and China. There's some hesitancy to engage on this. But Kerry had a real victory on Tuesday of this week when China announced that they will stop financing coal projects all over the world. That's huge. And I think that's a direct result of Kerry diplomacy. I think the article is maybe a little bit more pessimistic than it needs to be, because, you know, it's this image of this guy flying commercial, schlepping around the country, trying to get audiences with the right people. And then Lisa Friedman slides in at the end that 70% of new power generation around the world, 70% of the money is being spent on renewables. And I think, again, you know, the market sees the urgency of climate change, even if the U.S. Congress doesn't. So, you know, thank goodness for John Kerry and his team of 35 really hardworking policy wonks. I'm glad they are doing this. And I hope Congress is paying attention, because, you know, Kerry has the international portfolio, but it is, again, harder for him to do his job, not just explaining the Trump administration, but if he has to explain that the U.S. Congress would not adopt the Biden climate change priorities.
Alan.
Well, that's right. I think Judith, as always on this subject, is absolutely on the money. And, you know, you could either like him or not like him. After all, this is a guy who was a presidential candidate and a Democrat, and we have a Democrat in office. So I think his status, his stature, counts for an awful lot with people, you know, around the world who have to know that they got to get along with the United States one way or another. And that, of course, includes India and others. So I'm impressed by what Judith said.
Rosemary?
I think John Kerry comes off in that article as Don Quixote on a very quixotic mission. Mm-hmm. And that's the appeal of the story. But let me remind you that that means it's a losing cause. That's clearly what she thinks. And unlike Judith, I'm not so sure that it's overly pessimistic. It's exactly pessimistic enough. He has to, he is fighting it despite the odds against him, which he knew, which makes him indeed noble, like I say, Don Quixote. But he has to get this through a Congress that won't even vote to stop guns when children are being killed in the United States. And this, and we have fires and floods and storms right now in the United States. And there is absolutely no appetite for climate change legislation, witness Biden's own infrastructure bill. So I don't see that going to Scotland in November is going to change anything, despite all his hard work. I admire him. I'm glad he's doing it, but it just seems so huge a task. And he seems aware of that, too, and keeps fighting on, which makes him a hero. But we need more than a single hero now.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I have no doubt that John Kerry is doing his best and has an enormous amount of experience. I respect him, and I think he's the right person for that job. But he's not the president of the United States. And he wanted to be. He tried to be, but he's not. And what we really need right now is a president of the United States who can clearly communicate on the issue of the climate crisis that we're in and really articulate what exactly he plans to do about it and how he's going to use his power and his leadership skills to get Congress to cooperate with him. And I think this is the problem we have, is that no matter what John Kerry does, I don't currently see, unfortunately, a president who is capable of providing the type of leadership and communication that is necessary to take control on this issue and, quite frankly, many others.
Don't you have to give him a lot of credit, though, Terry, for having appointed a senior person of this quality who goes around and does what he is doing with the president's imprimatur on his forehead? I mean, it seems to me that you can't just dismiss the fact that he has taken this, that Biden has taken this step, appointed this senior guy who ran for president of the United States, who was a senator and who's one of the richest guys around, to do this work. I'm impressed by where he sits on the airplane, of course.
I certainly give him credit. I mean, he has hired and appointed a lot of very talented, highly skilled people. And that's something, of course, that Donald Trump would have never done or even known how to do. So, yes, I certainly give him credit for that. But we are at a point in time now where we do need to see action. We need to see follow through. We need to see this resonate in something more than just a New York Times article. And this story in itself is quite buried. You can't easily find it. It's not as prominent as it should be. I'd like to see Joe Biden talking more about what John Kerry is doing and what they're accomplishing working together. I'm just not hearing enough of that.
Judith, anything you'd like to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I think Terry makes some very valid points. I'm not a good judge of all of this because I read everything on climate change, but I don't think that it is penetrating mass media much. But, you know, Alan's right. I mean, having a former Secretary of State, a former U.S. Senator go all over the world carrying this message, you know, this position did not exist previously. When Kerry was Secretary of State, he did prioritize climate change along with nuclear disarmament and human rights and many other issues. So, you know, there's a saying in the climate change movement, to change everything, we need everyone. And having Kerry be part of everyone, I think only helps us. And the science is so compelling. The economics is so compelling. We're seeing more and more big institutions divesting, not just because of the ethical call of preserving human life as we know it. You know, the planet will survive. It's the people that are having the hard time with climate change. But if you just look at the economics of this, investing in fossil fuels loses you money. And yet the New York State teachers
are still invested in fossil fuels. So I think that's kind of the other divestment piece needs to move forward to lift up the work of John Kerry as he travels the globe.
But don't you think, Judith, that there is some progress here? I mean, I look at, for example, the New York State Pension Fund. You mentioned the teachers. And I do see that Tom DiNapoli has been making some moves to divest in places where he used to argue, you know, my job is to make money for the pension fund. So I think maybe slowly but surely it's beginning to get done.
Yes, it is slowly shifting, but winning slowly is losing because planet is getting warmer every month. And that is a huge problem. Sea level rise is increasing every month. I mean, just looking at this past summer, you know, the evidence of climate change is all over the world. And so I think, you know, as we've talked about on the show, the political feedback loop doesn't work. I mean, it's not working on the pandemic, right? I mean, a third of the nation still not vaccinated, and it's not really working fast enough on climate change. Attitudes are changing. The private marketplace is changing, which is perhaps most important. But we are, you know, we're not changing fast enough.
So why so slow to get to people, Judith?
I think there's a profound lack of political leadership on the climate change issue. I think Terry is right. You know, I think Biden has appointed great people. I think many, not all, but many of his policies on climate are very good. But it hasn't really kind of penetrated. I was talking to someone just yesterday, the incredible rainstorms that we're experiencing. And you still have a lot of people saying, oh, well, that's just the weather. Well, it's not just the weather. So it's, I mean, we have a lot of education to do, but more importantly, the role of fossil fuel companies in policymaking in Congress and in campaign contributions, I think, is the major thing standing in the way. The political influence of fossil fuel companies and their continued attempts at disinformation is a huge problem. Final point, former Congress member Sherry Bollert from the Utica area passed away earlier this week, age 83. He was such a Republican champion on acid rain issues. It wasn't that long ago you could get Republicans to support reducing air pollution in order to reverse acid rain. And I was thinking of his legacy and then fast forwarding to the political quagmire we're in today on climate change.
Terry.
Well, I think Judith got to what I was going to say, and she probably did it in a much more eloquent way than I'm going to do it. But I did want to point out that while we're having this very important discussion, the fossil fuel lobbying organizations are working in aggressive ways that it's hard, I think, for the average voter to understand. They are making substantial commitments to political parties and to political candidates that they will support them if they support their pro-fossil fuel legislation. And they are making commitments to political action committees that if this particular political candidate does not support our fossil fuel legislation, we will support running ads against them and do everything we can to get them out of office. These things are really happening, and they have enormous influence, unfortunately, because of our lax campaign finance laws. They have enormous influence over the people that will ultimately make the decisions. And many of these people that are being influenced are Democrats. And where we really need to see significant change is in the behavior of our elected officials in both parties in terms of how they actually take climate change seriously and pass laws to help us deal with this. And until we see that movement, it's going to be a scary time. And that's where I'm looking for the real change to happen. And I look to Joe Biden to jump in there and take control of that situation and to get it done. And I'm just not seeing that.
Terry Gibson on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 24th. Full episodes of the Roundtable Panel are available online at WAMC.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.